G'day folks, talk to Lisa Cox. A media professional, journalist, author, and fierce disability advocate. And we yarn about her acquired disability, a brain hemorrhage that led to the loss of limbs, other complications, and she died twice. And her trajectory of life after that, which has just skyrocketed, and where she broadcasts inclusivity for people with disability, trying to change the culture, the narrative, in media fashion, the general workforce, exposing industry giants, taking advantage of people with disability, like Sephora. She ain't afraid, no backpedaling, just moving forward. Love your work, Lisa. Keep it up. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. And we've got a Patreon page. So if you want to help further support the podcast, the channel, hit that link within the description. There's two tiers. So if you choose one of them, that'd be great. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah.
Righto, we're on. Lisa Cox, thanks a lot for parking some time aside and jumping on the podcast and having a yarn. Much appreciated.
No worries at all. Thanks so much for having me here, Jake.
Awesome. So you're up north, yeah? You're up in Queensland. So up in Brizzy, yeah. So just how's it going up there, up in Brisbane at the moment? And obviously you've got, you know, lockdowns and COVID, and, you know, it's a little bit more open where you are up that way compared to where I am in New South Wales. That, you know, it has opened up a little bit, but how's it going in general?
Yeah, pretty good. With regard to COVID, we've been fairly fortunate. We haven't had the lockdown in southern states. I mean, I'm only speaking for myself here, but I've been in lockdown for 16 years since I acquired my disability. So like a lot of the disability community, I don't want to speak to everyone, but we're all sort of shaking our heads going, what's the fuss? And again, I'm not speaking for everyone, but we're all being sort of in our varying states of isolation and homebound and whatnot, and not able to access facilities and get out and about for a long, long time. So even though everyone else is not able to get into place and go out, and so many of us, this new normal has been our normal for a long, long time. And I've written as many articles as I can about that and certainly spoken about it. But I think it's now getting on everyone's radar that this whole isolation, loneliness, boredom thing, it's like, oh, it's that thing you've been talking about and rushing on about for years and years. It really does exist. It really is true. You do get bored at home, and it's not just a matter of reading an inspirational quote on your fridge and, you know, doing some yoga. It really does exist. Boredom and isolation and loneliness is a thing. So I think the general population is kind of coming around to understanding now what an issue it is.
100%. And that's on board with you right there, because, and it's funny, hey, like how you're seeing, like what you just said there, like how a lot of people feel in general, and how it's a lot of people have always been in isolation due to disability, or if it's some people that have been incarcerated for the wrong reasons and whatever it may be. And it's sort of, and it's good to see the sense of the broader community where they can, in a way, draw comparisons and say, oh, this is what I'm feeling now. Well, maybe, you know, even though it's totally different, like compared to an able-bodied person or someone with disability or whatever it may be, but at the same time, it's like, hey, like from my point of view or maybe yours, it's like, hey, well, what are you whinging about? We've been like this for years, you know what I mean? So
I never wanted to make it a, you know, better or worse or anything like that. It was never a case of who's got better or worse, not a competition. But it certainly applies to not just the disability community, but an article I wrote for the Canberra Times. It's even new mothers who are breastfeeding at home, or immigrants or refugees, or like you said, people who are incarcerated, or people who aren't necessarily disabled, but for all different reasons, all different circumstances, find themselves homeless or for a number of different reasons in these isolated situations, and have been for years. These the rest of the population was finally having an understanding that, like I said before, it wasn't just a case of do some yoga and bring the inspirational quote and get over it. It was much deeper than that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's good seeing, like what you touched on there, that word intersectionality and all the different facets of, you know, different people, cultures and whatever it may be. And that's what I'm impressed with, like what you do, and it's, and whether it's got to, it's within mainstream media, right? And it's yourself showing the visibility and trying to elevate visibility of disability, and, you know, that we should be heard and we should be seen, and, you know, raising that bar. So that's why I'm really stoked to have you on, and where we'll touch on a lot of that. But, like, I know a lot with yourself, right, where you've got an acquired disability, and
yep,
like mine, and, you know, you said 16 years you've had your disability, and I'm just over a decade there too. So, and just want to touch on, because, you know, I know who you are now and we're talking, but who was Lisa Cox before the acquired disability? If we sort of want to reel it back a bit, and then,
sure,
if we can touch on that, if that's cool.
Yeah, no problems at all. So I was 24. I'd been to uni. I was living in Melbourne at the time. I was in corporate advertising. Loved my job. Had some great clients, doing the thing, climbing the corporate ladder, all of that sort of thing. Not doing a bad job, I suppose. You know, getting the promotions, getting the awards, doing what I thought was the right thing to get where I wanted to be, which was the bigger and better job eventually. In an okay relationship, and which eventually ended, thank heavens, because it meant I met my wonderful husband. But life was pretty good generally. I missed my family terribly because they're based in Brisbane, where I am now. But that was I was generally healthy. I was, you know, doing all those things. So life was, when I say it was fairly average, it was pretty mediocre 24-year-old life, going out with my friends, drinking too much champagne, doing all those sorts of things.
That's awesome.
A bit of traveling and
yeah. So just living life and
just living and life, loving it too. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and it's always tricky, hey, like when, you know, you're living life, you're in the corporate world, you're down in Melbourne, you're getting amongst it, and life's just rolling through, and then it's, you're never prepared for.
Oh no, I was not prepared.
Yeah.
Definitely not.
No, and just talk to us about that. So when you're looking at acquired disability, so where did that come from? And because it's pretty serious, like from what I've seen in media, right? And just, it looks like it, you know, pretty much hit you for six. But can you explain what it is, and then we can sort of touch on, you know, how it really took a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. So I'll preface this by saying that everything is what I've been told, in that I don't have a really clear memory of it. I have roughly 6 months of amnesia, like complete memory loss. So I don't remember months before my brain injury, my stroke. And I don't remember the months after that. So everything is based on what I was told and what the doctors sort of told me. So I was at Melbourne Airport one morning and by myself and went to get on a plane. I was flying home to see my family and I collapsed at the airport. So I had a brain hemorrhage or like a mini stroke.
So Jesus, at the airport.
At the airport, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd had a brain hemorrhage, a little stroke, and they took me to hospital, found, and that's where they discovered the bleed on my brain. Following that, all my organs shut down and I went into a coma for 3 weeks. And because all of my organs had shut down, I was on life support for 2 months. And following that, in hospital for over a year. And when I say in hospital, that was three separate hospitals, three. When I say three, that was the original intensive or the original hospital in Melbourne where they took me to in the coma. And then they realised that I was going to be in hospital for such a long time because I needed so many operations, including amputations, heart surgery, everything else. My family was literally living out of a suitcase on the hospital floor. And they went, this is not a healthy place for Lisa's family to be. They've flown up from Brisbane. We need to get her back to Brisbane because they can't, you know, live here for a year.
Yeah.
So they put me in a Learjet, an air ambulance. So they put me in an air ambulance and zipped me back to Brisbane.
Yeah.
And that's where I spent my time sort of going between to Prince Charles and the RBH, if anyone knows the hospitals in Brisbane, depending on what I needed done, what I needed chopped off or what surgery I needed. So when I say I was in hospital for a year, there were different hospitals involved until eventually I could come home. And then I went back more times for more surgery and procedures and things like that. But that first year was over over a dozen procedures, which included the amputation of my left leg, all of my right toes, and 9 of my fingertips. So I still have my left thumb.
Yep.
A total hip replacement. I came back for the total hip replacement. I've had heart surgery twice. I also came back for the second heart surgery. That was just before my wedding. And what else? Oh, they were all the main ones, but I suppose you can see all the scars and it's really obvious the disabilities that you can see there. But I don't know if you have yourself any invisible disabilities, but I always make a point of saying that you can see all of that stuff, but they're not particularly challenging. Like, it's not my wheelchair that stops me from going around the world, apart from COVID. It's not my wheelchair that stops me from doing all the things I've done. It's all of the invisible things up here from my brain injury, all of the invisible disabilities. It's all the things you can't see. So I always make this point, because there's a lot of people out there with invisible disabilities who are challenged daily, who will stop in the street and say, well, what's wrong with you? Why can't you do that? Or you haven't got a parking permit or for whatever reason. And it drives me absolutely bonkers. So this is why I always harp on about my personal experiences, that I'm almost, I don't want to say fortunate, but I'll use the word fortunate, that I do have this wheelchair to say that, yes, something is wrong with me. I have all of these invisible disabilities that are very, very challenging. They're more challenging than my wheelchair, in fact. They're more challenging than my prosthetic leg that you can see, my missing fingertips that you can see, all the scars covering my body that you can see. And so that's why I make a point of harping on about it every time. So I'm over 25% blind. My speech is sometimes affected depending on how much coffee or wine I've had to drink. And I also have chronic fatigue, chronic pain, and what else? Epilepsy and a few other things. My memory, that's right. I always forget my memory is not great as well.
Okay. God, you've touched on a lot there. And I'm glad you really made a definite point of invisible disabilities, because that's so important, especially, you know, because a lot of people don't understand it, obviously, because they can't see it. And people do have a perception of, you know, when they're looking at a person in a chair or some other physical disability and they have an idea or get an idea, but there's so much gray area when it comes to invisible disabilities and what people understand. And, you know, it's people, or, you know, whether it's, you know, people that work in allied health and, you know, people from all different walks of life. And it's always a tricky one when invisible disabilities get brought up, whether that's intellectual, mental, cognitive, soccer, social. There's so many different facets to it, and
for sure
how it affects a person, but trying to convey that to someone and getting them to understand. But so going the actual lot with the brain hemorrhage and the stroke, so that was from a bacterial infection, yeah?
From what I understand, the Streptococcus A is the name of the infection. That was what caused the brain hemorrhage. And then it all sort of snowballed from there. So the brain hemorrhage caused all of my organs to shut down. And then because all of my organs had shut down, they put me on some special medication, we'll call it, which was wonderful because it saved my life. But at the same time, one of the side effects was that it draws all the blood from your extremities, so from your fingers and toes and even from my nose. So it made all of them black and gangrenous, which meant they had to be amputated. So my fingers and toes and even my nose turned black for a little while, but I got to keep that. But, yeah, everything else had to be chopped off. So both of my arms and all of my legs were black for a little while. So the fact that I only lost some fingers and toes and a part of a leg, that's pretty great in my opinion. So I certainly could have lost a lot more.
And you died twice. Yeah?
Yeah.
And what was that? Like, have you got memory of that, or how did that feel?
Nothing exciting, no. No Hollywood stories of angels and men in
caves. Seeing the tunnel and the light.
Nothing exciting at all. No, just the way I explain it when I tell the story to kids is, if you're watching a medical drama or something, that if you're watching the screen where they have beep, 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 mum would have just been beep. So the flat line, I would have flatlined until I'd started up again. Obviously, I was resuscitated. But, it's not a very exciting story, even though it probably sounds very exciting.
Yeah.
I have no recollection of it whatsoever.
Yeah, but it's pretty serious. And the thing is, you're still here. That's the main thing. And, you know, you're moving, pushing forward, whether that's walking or rolling, and that's awesome. So, and I can see it on camera, and I've got one too. You can't see it because it's underneath my beard. Yeah, I've got a trachea out of my scar. You can't see it. And it's, you know, with me, it's not what, like, because it's the one scar that, on myself, I've got scars all over the shop, but the one scar that personally I don't like on myself, just, and it's not the reason why I grow a beard. I just don't like shaving and I like having a beard.
Amazing.
But it just reminds me of, you know, how serious it is to, you know, when you're thinking of oxygen and just being able to breathe, and how easily that can get taken away from you.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty serious. But
you've
Melbourne, flown up to back to Brizzy in the mix of all these different hospitals. So what was the rehabilitation process for you, like, you know, mentally and physically?
There were a lot of drugs involved, so I'll be completely honest, it was a bit of a hazy mess there. So my recollection of it is really, really hazy, but I do remember just thinking little steps. And so to backtrack a little bit, my upbringing or how it always been, I had a really big sporting and athletic background. And when I first started playing volleyball and sport and athletics, I was terrible, like really, really bad. All arms and legs, it's like 5'11" on me. I'm just lanky as heck and absolutely rotten. But when I started, I was so bad, but just train, just practice and practice and practice. After failing and failing and failing and being absolutely rotten at it, eventually I got a little bit better and a little bit better and not being afraid to fail. And eventually I was captaining the women's team nationals winning gold. So I sort of applied those same theories to my rehabilitation. Not that you can really compare the two, but in
No, it's all
my,
about mindset, though. It's all
yeah,
about mindset.
in my brain that was full of drugs, it made sense at the time, I suppose. I'm like, okay, I'll just apply those same strategies to my rehabilitation. Because I've done it so many times on the sporting field. I'm like, I'll just keep repeating this and not be afraid to fail. And that's what I did. And I know there are a few times where I just crumbled in the heap. Just couldn't bring myself, just could not do it. And I'm like, such a failure. I was absolutely devastated at what I the shell of a person I was. It was horrible. But I knew that no amount of I certainly had my down days, and I let myself have those down days because I certainly didn't just shove it all under the rug and go, no, you will not cry. You can't have bad days, because that's BS. I don't believe in any of that. So when I say I was just strong and stoic and I just got on with it, I let myself cry and I really, really shitty days. Can I swear on this podcast? Oh, good. Just checking. I absolutely let myself fall to pieces and cry and fall apart. But at the same time, I knew that no amount of feeling sorry for myself day after day after day forever was going to change anything. My leg was not going to grow back ever, no matter how many tears I cried. My brain injury, yes, it could get better, certain things, neuroplasticity, etc., but certain things were not going to change. There were things I could control, but there were other things that were totally out of my control. So I focused on what I could control. And that's sort of the game plan that I stuck to. So I stuck to the really small things that were within my control.
So, and things that are out of your control. So when you're talking about if it's got to do with phantom pain and some other ongoings to do with if it's some of your amputations and your ABI, so or some people sometimes call it, traumatic brain injury. So have you still got ongoings that obviously and you touched on chronic pain too, which is a massive one. So obviously you've got a lot of ongoing. So where's all
Sure,
that?
happy to talk about that. So I have peripheral neuropathy. So for anyone who doesn't know, peripheral neuropathy is just like a fancy term for pins and needles constantly in my right foot, my remaining right foot. And it's just a permanent pain that feels like pins and needles forever in my foot that will not go away. So it's here right now. I can feel it, and I could spend the next 40 minutes of our conversation focused on it, going fuck, 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 fuck. It's really annoying. But
Jesus.
instead, I'm focusing all my attention on this conversation. So when it first came to my attention that it was there, it was all I focused on. It was all I could think about. I spent far too much money and time and energy thinking about it every single minute of every single day. Acupuncturists, alternate medicine drugs, include prescription drugs like Lyrica, which some of your listeners may be aware of. So I went down the alternate route, and then I went down the medication. I tried everything. So, Basically, nothing worked. I felt like a complete failure in the end. But as it turned out, and I'm only speaking for myself here, but the number one thing that has worked for me has been distraction therapy. And distraction therapy is just keeping my mind busy. And for me, that's been things like writing and work and just keeping my attention and focus elsewhere, whether that's talking to you or doing something else to keep my focus and my attention off the pain, which I see a remedial masseuse and things like that for my other pain, and a physiotherapist for my other pain, which I also have. So depending on which body part we're talking about, different treatments for different things. But pain management is really, really individual, and it's a real bitch. It really, really is.
100%. And you know, I'm glad you touched on that. And I'm just going back to invisible disabilities again, because the importance of it, and because just looking at one of your blogs, right, and it drove me nuts when I read it, because I've gone through where I've seen different comparisons, not just, you know, from myself, where I've seen heaps of different individuals with various disabilities and where it's happened to them also, but just where you had a friend that drew comparisons on baby brain. And I'm just like, oh, come on, just because I could relate to it, but in a whole different other manner. But I just read that and I'm just like, geez, really? Again, like, you know, so can you touch on that story and the whole comparison and just where people, it's like they try and draw on a comparison to a disability and how someone's feeling, but it's just totally, you know, not right.
I guess people try to relate all the time, but I never get angry about it, only because I know people are trying to relate. I know that people are trying to form a connection. The very first event that I came to out of hospital happened to be a wedding. I can't even remember who was getting married, but I was in my wheelchair. Somebody approached me and said, "I know exactly how you're feeling. I spent a week in a wheelchair when I broke my leg." And I just turned around and I must have just glared at them and just, I can't even remember what I said, but it was probably not the right way to react. And then I realized later that they were just trying to make small talk, make a reaction. I've since come to learn, I was probably that person in my non-disabled days who was just trying to make a connection and just trying to say the right thing. So, yeah, people say dumb stuff to me all the time. But, yes, the blog you're referring to is that people trying to compare baby brain or forgetting things for 9 months being pregnant with a brain injury. And it was a while ago since I wrote that. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, kind of not the same thing. Yours will end, but mine is for life. Kind of not the same thing. So, yeah, it's very, very, very different. But, yeah, people do make comparisons all the time. And I've had the I know how you feel. I've been in a wheelchair for a week or a month after my big toe got bruised, or I've had those sorts of things said on multiple occasions, but I try to brush them off and not pay too much attention to it, to be completely honest.
It's tricky one, that one. And
yeah,
so, and just, you know, with the initial disability and, you know, going through the initial stages, and what was your concept of disability? And just, and because it's always tricky when you're looking at, and I don't really like using the word, but when you're looking at integration back into society, because you are in a way, so because you're going through life now in a different light. And it's like, you know, when you've got your groups of, you know, your family, your friends, your work colleagues. So when you're going through of you trying to figure out how life should be or what I can and can't do. So how were those initial stages?
It was different for me. Well, it was different for me for two reasons, because firstly, I came back to what I call a new town. Even though I grew up here, I essentially moved away for many, many years to work in my career and everything. So when I moved back, I had to form new friendship circles, not just as a disabled person, but as a new person to the city. So it was like a bit of a double whammy. But I was also at the same time discovering who I was as well, and learning my new body and my new boundaries. It took me a while to establish, and I only learned this a few years ago, new boundaries for my brain injury. An example of this is that I used to work in an advertising agency, and the hours in an advertising agency are like 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. 7 days a week, easy. And I came out of hospital and went, I'm going back into advertising, get me in there. And so I went back into an advertising agency thinking, I can do this. I'm only in a wheelchair. I've got nothing. Nothing's wrong with me. I'm fine. Look at me. I'm in a wheelchair. Nothing to say. Nothing's going to stop me. So I was even fooled by my invisible disabilities, and I crumpled in a heap and didn't realise that chronic fatigue and can actually be a really, really big problem. So,
yeah.
After a little while, I got a big smack in the head and soon realised that, yeah, no, that's actually going to be a lot more limiting. I mean, that they were great. I was completing the work. I was getting it signed off by my clients. I was getting work produced and meeting my deadlines, all of those sorts of things. So my work was quality and high enough standard, but I felt like absolute ratchet. So unfortunately, it was something that wasn't doable for me. So even me with invisible disabilities, I was fooled by them, even though I had them.
Yeah, and you know, because it's tricky enough when you're looking at, and I've used that word a few times, tricky, but when you're looking at the statistics, right? When you're looking at general corporate environments, and when you look at the percentages of women in certain higher occupation status, when you're looking at if it's CEO roles or CFOs or whatever it may be. And so then you've got that balance, or I should say the imbalance, and then you're throwing disability in the mix of it as well. So being a woman and then throwing disability in, like, how was that rolling or walking back into the office and just trying to go back to that word that I used before, is integration. So, and just trying the normality of it. We're trying to, you know, gain sense of that and showing the rest of your peers about, you know, who you are and what you are, and, you know, trying to elevate that.
Yeah, I've written about this a few times and spoken about this as well, that originally I was like pre-disability, and I suppose I joked about this in a way that my only, and when I say joked, inverted commas, joked, my only barrier to climbing the corporate ladder was my gender. And that, you know, there was this power imbalance with gender roles and gender pay gap. But with intersectionality, it's my disability as well. And this is what we talk about, or I have talked about with, you know, international movements, that we need to recognise equity as well as equality. We can't just talk about, you know, we need more women in boardrooms. And I'm like, let's talk about disabled women in boardrooms and disabled women. It's one thing to have you know, more women in the workforce, but all that means nothing if there's a flood of stairs at the front door or whatever the case, you know, whatever the case may be. And my background is in media and advertising communications, and trying to get more women or more disabled people, sorry, into those sorts of roles, into media roles, is something that I've been, when I say something I've been trying to do, it's a long way off happening. But getting more representation of disabled people in the media, or correct representation rather, is something that I've been focusing on more lately. So yes, I would absolutely love to wave a magic wand and get a disabled journalist as an anchor on the 6 o'clock news, but I think we're a few years behind, or a few years until that's going to happen just yet.
Yeah, we're getting there. It's chipping away. Like I see old Charles Eyes, a quadriplegic on ABC News, yes, down in South Australia.
Get him in Brisbane. I know. I can't get him on the news. Well, Jake, you're nearly there. You got a job. Yeah, you're doing this. You can do that.
Yeah, might have a crack one day. We'll see. I might be able to moonlight as a journo. See how we go. Yeah, awesome. No, but and looking at the accessibility, right? So, and when you were going into the workplace, and even now, I want to know what you see in the open environment and the hindrance of certain issues when it's got to do with accessibility, whether it's physically, when you're talking about stairs, elevators, and whatever it may, like TGSIs, handrails, all that sort of stuff, or what you see digitally that's not really accessible, and also touch on what you think is accessible and what really works and what should be promoted too.
Okay. So yeah, there's really, really obvious things. Stairs, for one. You know, stairs, elevators, all those sorts of things. But I wrote a piece for Inside Retail. I'm a contributor to Inside Retail, trying to get retailers and marketers and those sorts of people to understand that disabled people are consumers too. The disability dollar is huge and they need to start recognising that. So I'm really excited to be a contributor there at Inside Retail. But putting stairs at the front of a shop is just one way to make it accessible, because these days, especially during COVID, we're all doing a lot more shopping online. So making your retail space online more accessible is just as important. So I wrote a piece for Inside Retail about making an online store more accessible. And places like Media Diversity Australia have recently done a bit of a rejig of their website to try and make that more accessible also. So even though I'll be the first to admit my website it hasn't been touched in about a decade, so it's something I need to look at. But people like Steph Agnew have been really instrumental in helping us make changes there. But certainly digital platforms, more and more people are spending time online. So it's much bigger than just stairs and handrails. But making digital spaces accessible as well for things like screen readers. Even I worked with Australian Fashion Week recently, earlier in the year, and spoke to them about making their content accessible as well. So including image descriptions.
So important.
In the alt text. So in my Instagram post, for example, the reader can't see my image descriptions because I have really long captions, but anyone using a screen reader will be able to read them. So if you have a screen reader, you will be able to read the image descriptions, because I just add an image description to every single one of my posts, even though it's hidden behind the caption, but it is there for the screen reader and everyone reading them, if that makes sense. Anyone can add them if you want to know how to add them. It's just in the advanced settings section.
Yeah. I'm glad you pointed that out. That's because that's so important. And especially when you're looking at those digital platforms, whether it's Instagram and Facebook, and something I got pointed out to me a while ago, it was with a podcast I did with a lady, Sherry Byrne Haber over in, she's up in near Silicon Valley somewhere, and where she was just talking about how hard it is for people that are vision impaired with, when it's got to do with endless scrolling, you know, because then they don't really know where they are. There's no sort of, with Facebook or Instagram, it gets to page one. Now it just keeps on rolling through, and that's always a tricky one. So that they're getting better, like they're chipping away, and because, you know, these big social media platforms are, you know, they got the money to put more accessible features behind it, but there's still work to be done. But it's always about gradual improvement, which is good. And at Media Diversity Australia, can you explain to the listeners and viewers like what it is, what it represents, and your position?
Sure. So Media Diversity Australia are based in Sydney, and I came on board as the first disability affairs officer a couple of years ago, and they started out as an organisation that was looking at the cultural diversity across the Australian media landscape. But a few of us wanted to address the same sorts of issues, but through a disability lens as well, and that there's 20% of the Australian population roughly with the disabilities. So what we're doing at the moment is a really, really exciting project, because journalists by their very nature, and I've spent time in media, in comms, those sorts of things. I know some really, really great journalists. They don't really, really want to be assholes. They just don't know the right words to use. They really, really don't. It's just they don't know the right words to use. So they end up saying dumb things. They really do. I know, it drives me nuts. They use words like wheelchair bound. Lisa is in a wheelchair. Lisa is confined to a wheelchair, and it drives me bonkers. So we want to give them the right words to use. Now, I know these sorts of things have been put together in the past, but they've been put together by people who perhaps don't have an understanding of how the media runs, how the media works, what journalists need to know when they're on a deadline and they have 5 minutes to write 500 words and submit it to the editor. So we've put this together. It's been written by journalists in close consultation with a lot of people with disabilities, a really intersectional group of people with disabilities, gay people with disabilities, Indigenous people with disabilities, peak bodies, all sorts of people have been really, really careful to get as many people with disabilities as we can consult on this, paid consults. In this handbook, it is by no means a Bible, as in it's a working handbook. If we put it out there and people are like, oh, no, you change this, then we'll absolutely take that feedback on board and work on it in the future. So we want to put that out there to the journalists so they can finally have something to go on, because I've had so many journalists contact me and say, Lisa, how do I say this? How do I say that? What words do I use? And I'm a disability advocate. I should know what words to use, but I even get confused sometimes because
me too.
It's so different. And that's the one thing that we try, when I say everybody tries to share with journalists. There is no one way. Everybody is different. And us journalists, you have a right to ask, how do you, as the individual being interviewed, want to be referred to? There is no one way. There are certain words you don't use, obviously, but yes. How do you want to be referred to as? There is no one way. You know, just because I might want to be called this or that or the other, doesn't mean Jake wants to be. Right. And also what I try to do on my Instagram platform, for example, is not shame people and shout at them. And I try to use it. Some people don't
like it. It's education. It's just trying to teach people, you know.
Thank you for saying that, because some people make it very clear they don't like education, or that education is not the thing to do. But my personal view is that education is a privilege. I feel grateful that I can educate people, that I have a platform to educate people on. And if I
100%.
Can, if I can use my voice to educate people, then damn it, I will. So,
keep pushing it to the rooftops, you know?
That's the way I see education. I see some people like, fuck you, educate yourself, raw. That's not my view, each their own. But
you just get these assholes too, where they just got this poke the bear mentality, where they just, you know what I mean? So where they're just trying to, they don't want to, or they might take on the education, but they like stuff it and just sort of want to sort of poke and prod people and just, just try and fight.
Buy my book.
Yeah, that's it. No, just try and fire people up, you know, but, you know, knowledge is power. And if you can, like, have that, but in a positive light, and where, you know, and you're never too old to bloody learn. So exactly. If it's having, yeah, so it's, you know, you can think you have all the knowledge in the world, but it's like, you know, listen to these people. Everybody's got their own individual aspects when you're talking about disability and new findings that we have along the way, and how we, certain things we think should be portrayed or should be seen or heard. And it's like, well, hey, listen, well, maybe you want to write about it this way. Maybe you want to talk about it this way. You know, just don't get your back up. You know, maybe absorb it for a bit. Maybe have a look at the whole landscape and not be so bloody narrow-minded. So it drives me nuts, mate.
Exactly. So I'm, really, really excited about this. That it's not only going to change the language around people with disability, that it's also going to help break down some of the stereotypes, because the language we use to describe people with disability has the flow and effect to change, to affect the way that the broader society views us. So if someone, just to, for example, if someone day after day after day reads that a person with a disability reads language that we are to be pitied, that we are, you know, to be somebody to be pitied and need sympathy and this and this and this, and of course, when they see us in the supermarket, for example, that's why they have that.
Go and pat them on the head. Oh, how's it going?
That's how, you know, one thing leads to another, and that's how those stereotypes kind of lead to, if that makes sense to your audience. But hopefully, these sorts of handbooks can be a catalyst to change. Plus all of the other great stuff advocates are doing.
Yes, advocacy, diversity, in fashion. Love it. Hey, because I love clothes. I love threads. I'm a sucker for it. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Anna at Smart Alterations at Lake Haven, because I want to feel good, look good. Like everybody else, it doesn't matter if you're in a chair walking or whatever your ability or disability is, you know. So, and I get all my stuff altered to sort of to fit and suit me, whether it's jeans, suit pants, all sorts of gear, right?
Awesome.
Yeah, big believer in it. And just the accessibility of it. So talk to us about your involvement in fashion and accessibility. Love it.
All right. Well, that has been something that I never thought was going to happen, but has kind of evolved into something that I'm doing these days. So, there's this strange misconception out there that people with disabilities just don't care what they look like. And as my dear friend Carol Taylor from Carol Taylor Design said, Shout out, Carol Tower Design. Yeah, she's got her disabilities, but she hasn't lost her vanity. a good tailor. They certainly make some corn off us, that's for sure, because I haven't got any shout outs there. But it's a common misconception that we just acquired disabilities or born disabilities or something, and we just don't care what we look like. And it's not to say we're all Kim Kardashians or anything, but geez, we still have a bit of self-respect and pride and those sorts of things. Fashion, I suppose I chose to do a little bit of work in that because I was speaking to a friend about it, and I was trying to find a stream of popular culture that was easy to tap into, that the general public could easily get their heads around, that wasn't political, and that could be that was universal, I suppose, that both disabled and non-disabled people could easily come together on. And something like sport and music and the arts and fashion was one of those things that, whether you're disabled or not disabled, both sides have an appreciation of it, obviously for different reasons and different styles and those sorts of things. And I have an appreciation of it, not for, $10,000 Gucci dresses or anything like that.
Mm.
But I certainly wear more gym wear than most. But, I've been doing more and more in that space and absolutely loving it and really, really getting a good response from it, from disabled and non-disabled people as well.
Yeah, because I've seen some of the work with Christina Stevens, yeah? So there's like is a clothing company, yeah?
Yeah, so there's, within fashion, there's two types within the sort of work that I do. There's mainstream brands that use, it's just like, ordinary clothing that uses a disabled person within their advertising, marketing, modelling, and that sort of thing.
Mm.
But it's mainstream clothing. I don't want to use the word normal clothing, but ordinary clothing. And then there's
That's better. Ordinary, I'll get you. Yeah, yeah.
And then there's inclusive fashion. So inclusive fashion or adaptive fashion is fashion that's made specifically for the needs of people, wheelchair users, or people who wear catheter bags, or any number of things. So they're very, very specific. So it might be someone who stands but wears a catheter, or sits in a wheelchair but needs a higher waist so you don't see bum crack when you bend over, or, there's all sorts of things. And Christina Stevens is that brand. And Carol Taylor, who I mentioned before, she's a quad. And that is also one of those brands. So they have things like magnets instead of buttons. So I don't use magnets anymore. Sorry, I don't use buttons anymore. I can't use them very well. My husband does them up, or somebody else has stood them up, since I lost none of my fingertips. So magnets or Velcros is just used in place of the buttons and special clips and all sorts of things like that. So they're the two sorts of fashion. But inclusive fashion has been it's a few years ahead in places like America. There's a place called Patty and Ricky over in the States, and they're several years ahead of us.
Yeah, right.
Picking up speed here in Australia. I'm really proud of what's been happening here in Australia, especially in little old Brizzy, because Christina Stevens and Carol and some other places like Jan the Label have really been doing a great job.
Oh, they have, from what I've seen, Hey, and if it's anything on the menswear side of things, chuck me in there, I'll have a crack.
But,
because you know, I'm all about it. And it's also got to do with, you know, diversity, but functionality, what you've touched on there when you're talking about buttons and Velcro. But and it's little things as well, like when it's got to do with accessibility, like if it's like with me with certain jeans or certain other types of pants I want to wear, but if things are pressure related, I put different types of fabrics and stuff in certain places because, you know, I'm in my chair for a long time, so I don't want certain materials that are going to sort of not be good, you know, for the skin or the backside, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's all these little nuances that you can throw in the mix that make clothing accessible and inclusive so people can go out, walk and roll and feel good and look good. And that's what it's all
absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. And that's why having fun with the lived experience is so important because Carol understands that really well. She's bored and she knows that a seam in the wrong place can just be game over because pressure injuries, I've had pressure injuries, I get it. And like somebody who doesn't have that lived experience just wouldn't understand. It's like, what's the problem with the seam? But she knows all about that and we've had conversations about it and she would absolutely build that into her design. So having and this goes for anything, whether it's fashion or a boardroom for something else, but having someone with a disability at the table, if you're having a meeting about a disability-related topic, having someone with a lived experience at the table is essential.
Big time. Always comes down to the end user.
Yeah.
Always. Yep. You know, and then that's just going to bring exclusivity. You know, it's raising the bar. It's making sure that, you know, voices are heard and it just helps out the general population as well when it's got to do with just understanding. And, yeah, we're not here getting pushed or thrown into a corner and, you know, not being seen or heard. So it's, you know, just raising the bar. And talking about being pushed in a corner and, you know, funneled away, I wanted to touch on the makeup giant Sephora. Here we go. So just, you know, claiming inclusivity, having 150 people that they were hiring over, from what I believe, over in the States. But these 150 people that they were elevating through their media and whatnot, like you said, puffing their chest, we've hired 150 people and we're inclusive and bringing more people with disabilities on. But where were they throughout the whole company, you know, from working in the main office and everywhere in between? No, they're just shoved into the bloody factory in the back corner, packing boxes. Hey, there's nothing wrong with packing boxes and doing that, but it's, you know, having people that may want to do that, but there's other people like what you've touched on that are working in, you know, the ivory tower at HQ or, you know, or different roles to do with journalism or media or so many different facets to that whole industry, what people with disability can do. So talk to us about how they just shoved all this mob in the back corner.
Right. Well, yeah, so backtracking, I got a whiff of a news article that came out that Sephora, massive makeup brand for anyone who doesn't know, they hired 150 disabled staff. And something smelled a bit off because it almost sounded too good to be true because they were making such a big deal of it in press releases and the CEO was fronting the camera and look at me, look at us. Aren't we great? And I thought, something smells a bit fishy. You wouldn't make this big a deal for hiring 150 non-disabled staff. What's going on? So I dug a little bit deeper. And fair enough, all of the staff were being hired in the warehouse. And that pissed me off for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. Firstly, no one was going to see these staff. So, first of all, great. The warehouse is perfect for some people. If you want that job, great.
Fair enough.
Yeah. But as my I do also want to point out that I'm not for calling people out. As I did mention in my Instagram post, I did try and call them nationally, call them internationally, privately message them several times, email them, tried all of these things privately, got no response. I'm like, right, I'm writing an article and I'm writing another one. And I'm posting this. So after I had tried multiple times, then I read the articles and started talking about it. So, yeah, it really got my goat because there were no jobs being offered in PR, in HR, in finance, in the boardroom, in all of these places where disabled people are more than capable of working, and it really just encourages this stereotype that disabled people are only good for packing boxes, and that infuriated me.
Drives me nuts, you know. And that's the thing, there's so many roles that people with disability can take on. So yeah. And what is, you know, and I know it's not always, you know, just about calling people out, but sometimes you have to, you know, just put out there what's right, but then it's not just to shake up what that organisation has done, but it's hopefully other organisations look at that too and are like, okay, well, we don't want to be in the same boat. Or it's like education. So it's like what we can do to make the workplace more accessible, more inclusive for all.
But that's right. The article that I wrote for Inside Retail was, okay, so this really big mistake was made, but on the positive side, a learning opportunity, silver lining, we can all learn from this giant fuck up. Here are all the learnings we can make from it. So for starters, when you do this, when you hire a person with a disability, don't put on a big show about it. Don't call in a massive, like if you wouldn't do it for a non-disabled person, don't do it for a disabled person. You just look like an idiot. So secondly, if you're, you know, hire at all levels, if you're going to hire people to answer the phones, hire people at all levels of management, at the boardroom as well, in the finance department, the PR department, everything. And there were several other suggestions that I made in there as well as to how, for example, Sephora Australia and other Sephoras around the world can learn from this absolutely giant mess up that Sephora in the US had made, and not just Sephora but other makeup companies, because these Sephora is a global leader, one of the world's largest makeup brands. It's a huge mess up that they made.
So what have they done since? Have they balanced anything out yet or what?
I can't be sure, to tell you the truth. I'm kind of hoping that they sort of hoped it would go away, pushed under the rug and hoped it would go away.
Yeah, well, hopefully not. Hopefully, you know, they're bringing more mob in to, you know, work on different facets within and different departments,
some,
you know.
Put some people with disabilities in your marketing and advertising, for example, because we have, Jake doesn't, or maybe you do, but people with disabilities have cash to spend on your products, for example.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's like, and that's the thing that drives me nuts too, don't just assume, you know, everybody with a disability is on the disability support pension and, you know, don't have jobs and can't support themselves. Like,
yeah,
man, like the amount of time that assumption is, I've seen it brung up, it's,
yeah,
drives me nuts. But so what can employers do across, like if you're just waving the magic wand and if it's raising the bar of getting people with disabilities into the workplace, what would you do? What can you see?
Can you mean with the initial job placement?
Yeah, job placements and what they can do, whether it's got to do with just job placement, accessibility, or just raising the bar, because, you know, like with certain, if it's different sectors, right, and then they might go, if it's got to do with, say, retail or government or like all the different sectors or even construction, whatever it may be, and they're like, well, we're going to have X amount of percentage of Aboriginal people that are going to be, that we want to raise a bar to work in this sector. Or now we want X amount of, because I know, just say with the agency in Australia, how we've got the National Disability Insurance Scheme, like they'll be putting numbers out and saying, well, we want X amount of people with disabilities, this percentage to be working within our government offices, or whether it's the local area coordinators or out in the field, wherever it may be. So what would you like, or what do you want to see the improvements of?
Consider the channels that they're perhaps advertising through, for starters. Like, if they're only advertising through channels where a certain demographic are going to be viewing those ads, then you're only going to get the same sorts of people applying. So if you're not putting your ads where a disabled person is going to be viewing it, or if you're not, for example, putting alt text with your job ad, for example, so someone's screen reader can't, little things like that, then you're not going to capture those extra people with disabilities. So this might be a really bad example, but let's just assume, and I know this is wrong, but let's just assume for argument's sake that no one with a disability is on Seek. That's incorrect, I know for a fact. Let's just assume, but they put all their jobs on Seek.com. That for a start would just be the wrong way to go about it.
Yeah, I'm glad you said Seek, because they just, not too long ago, you would have heard a higher up. They just yeah, so they just injected $40 million into higher up the business. So they're a major partner with them. So yes, we'll look at,
I know,
look
at, Higher Up are awesome. They've just sponsored the Disability Reporting Handbook, and we love Higher Up.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, yeah, that's it. You know, it works with their system, you know, works for some, and in yeah, Higher Up. No, they're doing a good job. Like, it works for some people, and when it's got to do with controlling their own destiny within, you know, their NDIS plan and the direction that they can have choice and control and what they want to do to, you know, obtain certain carers and whatnot. So, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens with them now, like now that they've had that, because now I know they've had that massive injection. I know their logo's changed. It's going to be interesting to see what happens on that platform. So, you know, they're always elevating, and it's good having, you know, more high tide raises all canoes. So, yeah, you know, the more influence, the more money, the more, you know, adequate, equitable providers that are out in the community doing the right thing and helping with people with disabilities, that's what we need at the end of the day. So under, when you got to do with disabilities, with, you know, the majority of people that have a disability, and the scheme that they're under is a National Disability Insurance Scheme. So are you currently utilizing that scheme yourself?
I sure am. Yep.
Yeah. And how is it going for yourself, and what do you think of the scheme in general?
Bit of good, bit of bad, generally. I've personally had some pretty good experiences with it. I use it for all sorts of things. I have an exercise physiologist that I see. It's just been amazing to use it for that, because I can't be trusted to do certain things. And I see him to just get my functional movement, to maintain my functional movement. I don't want to be at the Paralympics in 4 years' time. I just want to be able to get myself off the couch tomorrow evening. So it's just to be able to maintain a certain level of functional movement. So I work with him doing really, really basic stuff like that. Generally pretty good. You're pretty happy with it?
With the scam itself. Yeah, I'm pretty happy. There's always room for improvement. As I said, it's the second biggest reform since Medicare, and it's still a new scheme. Like, it's only been around, like, we're pushing closer to a decade now that, you know, it's been around, and, you know, it's a massive shake up to the community and what each state and territory, what they did have, and then conforming to the scheme federally and what that represents, and also to, you know, where it really affects the people with the disabilities in the community. So, and it's everybody trying to get used to it. For me personally, it really works out and I'm pretty happy with it. There's like, and I knew as soon as it rolled over and I, you know, got my first plan, it was going to be a work in progress. And there was things that I would go to the local office or to the planner about, because, you know, I read in everything, and when it's got to do with the legislation and what you can and can't do. And I'm like, well, you know, well, I mean, you know, the minister has signed this off. So, hey, well, if he said it, we can go along and get this going, and we should be putting this in my plan. And really it's understanding the language of it, because, you know, the way that the planners or the LACs talk to individuals in the community, like, sometimes it's hard for people to understand what they're going on about, what's within the scheme, what is choice and control, what is reasonable and necessary, what does this mean, what does that mean, because a lot of it's broad brush what comes across in an NDIS plan. And it's, you know, it's good that they've got support coordination and people to help navigate that scheme for individuals. And, you know, because that's what I currently do in the community now. Like, I'm a, you know, I own it, well, myself and my wife, we own and run Culture Connects, which is a registered national disability service provider, and we deal with other schemes with disability also. But it's, you know, where we help individuals understand the language of the NDIS. So, because it's still a work in progress, and I'm involved in different reference groups as well with the NDIS, and which is great. And, you know, trying to, and it's, and I really want to try and help the scheme and help it work, and wherever it's talking to other individuals like yourself and with disability, and finding out, you know, what they like, what they don't like. And, you know, it's given that, those real stories, you know, given that to, you know, the broader community, or where the NDIS, where the government can hear this, and where it is tinkering around and making these changes. So at the end of the day, it's helping people with disabilities, you know, where it's got to do with the bricks and mortar, you know, building SDA compliant houses, specialist disability accommodations, still independent living options, and, you know, whether it's getting the right type of disability support workers out in the community, whether that's, you know, to do in Aboriginal communities, like, you know, cold groups, different cultural groups out in the community, and just trying to balance all that out. It's so tricky. But yeah, in general, I think the NDIS is working, and it's going to be a continual ongoing process to help improvement. And, you know, there's people like myself and you and all other people out there with different disabilities, whether it's physical or invisible disabilities. And that's, and I just want to point out there, that's like, I've got gripes with that. They're the people that get taken advantage of the most when it's got to do with the NDIS. It's people that are, that have those cognitive, intellectual, psychosocial disabilities that will just sign service agreements away when they don't really understand. And you get, there's a lot of unsavory service providers out there that do take advantage of these people and absolutely gouge their plans. And all of a sudden, you know, they got a year's worth of funds and they've been exhausted in 3 months, 2 months. I've seen it. It's nuts. And it drives me wild. You know, that's another big reason. Like, I'm an advocate first and foremost, but it was another driving reason of getting myself in the NDIS and trying to make a difference there, you know? So, man, you know, that's a whole nother podcast in itself. So, yeah, but, you know, going, jumping into, and that's what I love, the work that you're doing, and it's highlighting a lot of these issues and yourself with journalism. But hey, you're a bloody author too. So tell me about these books that you got out there.
Oh, the books are a whole different podcast, a whole different train of thought again. So originally when I started, like, back again, when I first, what's the word? Sorry, this is a thing with brain injury. I'm like, what was I thinking again? What was I saying?
It's all good. Take your time.
Started to grow. I'm like, what will I start doing with my life? What will I speak about? What will I? So I thought my platform is going to be body image. And I thought, I want to speak to young women and young girls. And I've got this media background, and I want to speak to young women about body confidence and media. Because when I was 17 or 12, I flipped through, you know, Dolly magazine or Girlfriend magazine, and I thought those pictures were real because I had no concept of airbrushing and things like that, and just thought, that's what it looks like, and my skin doesn't look like that. And I just had no concept of these things. And so I want to speak to 12-year-old girls and say, hey, you can still love your body, you can still love yourself and be confident and have a complete messed up body like mine and not in a really narcissistic Kim Kardashian egotistical way, but you can still be okay with yourself and at peace with yourself. It's okay. So I just wanted to, and as well as I suppose all sorts of other things, and that was going through my platform to speak from about body confidence and media and those sorts of things, sort of lifting the veil of what happens in media behind the scenes and how we take images and what we do to them. And then when I left my presentations, the girls always had so many questions and this and that and this. I need to put this in a book and give it to the girls. So that's the book I put together. And then I started doing more work with boys as well, and then went together for the boys. So the books have absolutely nothing to do with disability, and we're back way in the days before I started doing all of this disability advocacy stuff. So that's the backstory on the books. It's sort of more media body image type stuff that I was doing before I started on this exciting journey.
It's awesome. And so a lot of it, and it's good to see a lot of your experiences, right? You know, what you've got through the good, the bad, and the ugly, and how that's where that's really galvanized, you know, who you are as, you know, as a person, but where you can see it through your journalism. And is that fair to say? So, like, just your experiences, like, that's really galvanized who you are as a person, and with your journalism, pushing it out there for, you know, when it's got to do with, like, not, how am I trying to say this, right? So it's not to go through the pity route, and it's not to go, it's like, yes, we're people with disability, but, and I have gone through these experiences, but, you know, you're using that, like, whether it's got to do with pain or sorrow or loss or whatever it may be, to really take those experiences and then let that, it's sort of hardening up in a way, so then you're pushing positives out from that, or where it can elevate inclusivity. Is that sort of making sense in a way?
Yeah. There's never been a pity, poor me, everyone feel sorry for me. There's never been an element of that to anything I do. I never ever want anyone's pity or sympathy. There are plenty of people in the world who genuinely need that, but I'm not one of them. I'm sitting here in my little air-conditioned apartment in Brisbane. I don't need pity or sympathy, and there are people in palliative care in the hospital a few suburbs from me who do. So please give it to them.
100%. So in regards to your consultancy, so some of the works that you do there, so what does that cover in general? with Lisa Cox.
Oh, all sorts of fun stuff. So it could be with a brand or a business who want to bring me on with a marketing or an advertising campaign they're doing, and they want to know how to do diversity and inclusion in the campaign and do it properly or do it well and not be called out on Twitter and just F it up. So I'll, you know, talk them through a long-term strategy and how to incorporate disability over the long term, not just like stick one disabled model in one ad and then just go to the diversity box and go, okay, we're done for the year, thank you. And then
is it sort of getting their copywriters or whatever it may be to sort of get a sense of what it's like to have a disability and sort of write in that way so they're putting out the right language like you've talked about before?
There can be a little bit of that, or sometimes I'll help. Either I'll write some of the copy myself. It's I don't know. It can be hard to sort of I don't know. It's
like to get them to really convey what you say should be written. Is that
so nuanced with language, so nuanced, and you won't understand. You can just get a word or a phrase just a tiny little bit wrong, and the whole fucking internet will explode and lose my minds because, oh my god, you said this and not that and So quite often I'll just either, you know, I'll tweak it really carefully or edit it really carefully, and so I'll help them through it. Or sometimes, like I was working with Australian Fashion Week earlier this year, and that was working on the accessibility of the entire event. So rather than just look at sticking one model on a runway and just go, yep, okay, fine, we've been accessible, tick the diversity box, they brought us on months and months beforehand to make sure the entire event was accessible for people with disabilities. So the website.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the website, all of the wording on the website, I went through every word on that website and was like, okay, you've got to change that word, you've got to change that phrase, you've got to put a hyperlink there, and they changed it all, which they're awesome for. And then a few other things, they gave me a map and they said, right, we're putting a ramp in here, but just little things like that, which to an untrained eye would be like, yeah, no big deal, but to me was just priceless. I had another disability consultant who's vision impaired, and so she was able to go through it with the with that perspective as someone who, you know, can't necessarily see signs or needs extra assistance with signage. And I've got low vision, so yeah, between us we were able to sort of look at it through different lenses. So those sorts of things we were brought on months in advance to make sure it was all accessible for consumers. So it wasn't just a tick box case of we've got, you know, one wheelchair on and get fine.
That's so good. Like, it sounds like they really went in deep on that one, which is
They did. And full credit to them. That was all their idea. It wasn't a case of us going, no, you should really do this and this and this. That was all their idea. Yeah,
good stuff. So hopefully, you know, with the world opening up, you know, and if this is around the country, hopefully that's going to follow suit. So
We've already started talking about next year and planning even now months before that's started again. So it's exciting.
It's awesome. So, hey, is there anything else that you'd like to touch on before we start wrapping this up?
Not at the moment, other than happy birthday to my mum. I'm going to her birthday today, so she won't hear this, but happy birthday, Mum.
Happy birthday, Mum. Mum Cox. That's awesome.
Thanks so much for your time, Jake. It's been really good talking to you.
Good talking to you too. Hey, so throw out your social media handles. How can people get in contact with you? They look want to look at your Insta, your blogs, whatever it may be, throw it out there.
Well, I'm really, really lazy. So even though I'm on different platforms, I'm only ever checking Instagram, and that's lisacox.co, lisacox.co. And that's also my website, lisacox.co. And then if you try and find me on LinkedIn, you might not get a response for like 6 months or something. But yeah, that's where I find me, just on Insta.
Well, you heard it, folks. So if you want to reach out and look at it, Lisa Cox's good work that she's doing, you can see it all over Insta and on a website, and the important consultancy work, reach out. So Lisa, much appreciated for giving us your time today and just having an open, honest yarn. So important, and just to talk about all things inclusive when it's got to do with disability. So much appreciated.
Thanks so much, Jake. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks. Cool. See, folks, Lisa's doing solid work, exposing the truths and pushing for inclusivity for people with disability. Doesn't matter if it's the workforce, media, fashion, and everything that we touched on there. And where people with disability should be heard. We're not just to be pushed in a corner, shut the door, set and forget. No. Should be included in all facets of life. And she really elevates that pitch, and she's got a solid platform to do so. So I really appreciate it, Lisa, and I know a lot of others out there would too. Keep it up. Solid work. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. And we've also got a Patreon page. So if you want to help further support the podcaster channel, the link is within the description. Click into that. There's two tiers. You choose one of them for ongoing support. And want to roll with the squad, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at streetrollingcheetah, or email one word, streetrollingcheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electrical chairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So, righto, see you on the next one.